Author Ayelet Waldman once said she loves her husband more than she loves her children. She admitted these feelings made her, in the eyes of many, a bad mother. Conveniently, that's also the name of a recent collection of essays she wrote, in which she explores with honesty and humor what it means to be a mom in a culture where motherhood is often idealized. Here she is for our series, Three Books, where authors talk about three books on one theme.
Nowadays, it seems, there are two ways, and only two, to write about motherhood. There's cloying sentimentality, the kind most often seen on websites with soundtracks heavy on the Tchaikovsky, or in slim volumes with pastel pink covers and titles like A Letter to My Darling Little One. More popular lately, though, is the bitter and cynical motherhood is hell school. I am heartily sick of both. I'm no sentimentalist, but clearly there's something about the project of motherhood that I enjoy. I've done it, after all, four times. This year, I've decided to embrace books that are bracing and honest, yet do not shirk from the pleasures of parenthood. Books that tell the truth, but in which the truth is more joy than bitterness. Shirley Jackson, author of one of the most marvelously sinister novels of all time, The Haunting of Hill House, and of the short story The Lottery, also wrote two charming autobiographical novels about raising her four children in a ramshackle farmhouse in rural Vermont. In my favorite, Life Among the Savages, Jackson's humor is as snappy as her horror is creepy, and her children, though as messy and obstreperous as mine, seem never to inspire in her anything worse than a fond exasperation. The title story of Amy Bloom's short story collection, A Blind Man Can See How Much I Love You, contains one of the most absolute expressions of a mother's love in fiction. In this collection, ordinary women rise to the occasion demanded by motherhood. They make mistakes, some terrible, but they generally succeed in making up for them. My last recommendation is not about mothers at all, but about fathers, or rather, one father in particular. In his memoir, Family Man, Calvin Trillin writes with marvelous good humor about his wife and daughters. Getting advice on the best way to bring up children, Trillin writes, is like getting advice on the best way to breathe. Sooner or later, you're probably going to forget it and go back to your regular old in and out. Trillin gives the impression of being the best kind of husband. He not only wears the snugly and pulls his domestic weight, he's utterly enchanted by his family. Trillin and Family Man are so appealing and vicariously pleasurable that the book amounts to no less than mommy porn.
Ayelet Waldman is the author of the book Bad Mother, a chronicle of maternal crimes, minor calamities, and occasional moments of grace. She lives in San Francisco. Her three books were Life Among the Savages by Shirley Jackson, A Blind Man Can See How Much I Love You by Amy Bloom, and Family Man by Calvin Trillin. For more books coverage, authors, interviews, commentaries, and reviews, go to npr.org.
Now, even if your region is not covered by a sheet of oil, it's a tough time to find a job. That means it's a tough time for college graduates to start a career. This week, we've been talking with college graduates trying to do that. And this morning, we'll get a read on their prospects from Edwin Koch. He's research director at the National Association of Colleges and Employers in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And he spoke with Renee Montaigne.
Now, the economy, by many accounts, is rebounding somewhat. Are the 2010 graduates going to have any easier time finding jobs than last year's graduates?
Slightly easier time than last year's graduates. Last year's graduates faced a very difficult job market. This year, the prospects have gotten better only at the very end of recruiting season.
Our reporters have been talking to college graduates around the country. There's a young man in Montana who studied television production, an accounting major in Ohio. From your research, who has the best chance of getting a job?
Well, the accounting major would have the best chance because the offer rates for accounting majors are higher than for any other of the majors that we took a look at. It's not a great year even for accountants, but by comparison with everybody else, it's better. Besides accounting, the top majors were computer science, engineering, mathematics.
So is there research on how long the average job search is taking for this year's college graduates?
Well, we ask our students how long that they've been looking. And the average for those that have found a job, they've been looking anywhere from 6 to 9 months.
You were talking about last year that was very hard to get a job. Are those graduates who are now a year out of college, are they starting to get jobs?
They're still out there. When an employer recruits for college students, they're looking for new college graduates. And when a college grad has been out there for a year, they're classified in a somewhat different way as an experienced worker. And so they have more challenges in that regard.
You get a little tainted after a while when you're out there without a job?
Well, it depends on what you've done during that course of the year. You can't sit there and not do anything. One of the options, if there are no jobs available, is to do volunteer work. You know, last year, the Peace Corps and Teach for America were very popular options.
I wanted to ask you about the English major that we heard from earlier this week. Now, she said that if she couldn't get a job, she would work through a temp agency. Is that a good way to go or not so good a way to go?
It's a better way than not doing anything. It does put you in the job market, gives you an experience profile. And actually, if you're working for a temp agency, many times that can really translate into directly into a job. So it is a good way to go.
Now, in years past, and actually generally, I'm sure there's a lot of mothers and fathers out there who've said, you know, go into nursing, go into teaching. There'll always be a job. But I gather those are two fields that are a little bumpy right now.
Well, healthcare, not so much. For teachers, education majors this year, this was the weakest year we've seen in a long time. They actually fall at the very bottom of the majors list in terms of getting job offers. And I think that has a lot to do with the shortfall in government funds right now. Most of the liberal arts fields are not doing particularly well. They tend to fall towards the bottom in most years. However, once they get into a career path, some longitudinal studies have shown that these majors do well enough after 10 years that they've really caught up to a great extent to the more technical degree majors.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Edwin Koch is Research Director at the National Association of Colleges and Employers.
Next week, we continue our series setting out with a graduate in Miami who is cleaning pools while waiting for a career in air traffic control to take off.
This job is not bad for somebody that doesn't have a degree or anything. It's not a bad job. It's just not for me.
We'll be setting out on that story next week.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. If you're looking for a new summer thriller to put into the beach bag, here's one for you. It's actually for your kids, but it's a taut legal drama that adults will enjoy, too. The book is called Theodore Boone, Kid Lawyer. And get this, it's written by best-selling author John Grisham. The central character is 13-year-old Theo Boone, who loves everything about the legal system, loves it so much that when there's a murder in his town, he makes sure his class is able to attend the trial. Earlier today, I spoke with John Grisham, and he told me that Theo's world is defined by his parents.
Theo is an only child. Both of his parents are lawyers. They practice together in a small office called Boone and Boone. And so all they do is talk about the law. The law is all Theo has ever known. And for fun, as a family, they watch Perry Mason reruns. And they talk about the law over breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And it's, you know, it's just what Theo has grown up with. He loves the courtroom and the courthouse. He knows every lawyer, every judge, every clerk, every policeman. He actually has an office at Boone and Boone, a little small room that he calls his law office, and that's where he does his homework in the afternoon. He actually sees clients there. He gives legal advice to his friends, and he gets in all kinds of trouble because of this.
How do you calibrate the use of suspense and fear in a children's novel? Because you want to, I guess, titillate a child's senses, but you don't want to scare the bejesus out of them.
Well, I'll tell you, it's something I think I'm still learning. The first draft of Theo, I was very hesitant to place Theo in actual physical danger. And so I toned down the suspense. I wanted some fear because obviously you have to be realistic. And then once I started working with the editor at Penguin, she said, look, you know, we need some more. It's okay in kids' books. It's okay to have the kid in danger. And I remember thinking back, my favorite book as a kid was, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. And I loved that book, and I loved it when I was 12 years old. And Tom was always, Tom and Huck, were always in trouble, often in danger. And it made the story that much more entertaining. And so I went back through Theo the second and third and fourth times and kept tweaking it to add a little more suspense, a little more fear, a little more danger. And, again, I'm learning. This is all something new to me. And it's not necessarily any easier than adult fiction. It's easier in that it's shorter. The plot is not nearly as complicated. There are certain things you can't do in a kid's book. But the challenge, the biggest challenge I found was the ability or trying to tell the story without talking down to kids, because they that's what I think a lot of writers do, and they don't like it. Kids don't like it. They want you to treat them as your equal and tell them a story.
Do you mind, since we're talking about how you build suspense, I would love if you would read a portion of this, and I was thinking about page 110.
I can set this up for you.
Okay.
Julio is a kid from El Salvador who is in Theo's school, but Julio has a cousin who works at the golf course where this murder occurred, and there's a very good chance that this cousin, who's an illegal immigrant, saw something that maybe he was not expecting to see at the time the murder occurred. And this is when Julio and Theo are talking. You see, Julio said, he was working on the day of the murder. He was eating lunch. His lunch break starts at 11:30 and goes to 12. He's very homesick, and on most days he sneaks away from the others and eats alone. He carries a family photo of his mother, father, and four little brothers. And while he eats, he looks up the photo. It makes him very sad, but it also reminds him of why he's here. He sends them money every month. They're very poor. Where does he eat lunch? Theo asked, but he already had a clue. Well, my cousin was sitting under some trees in a dog leg, sort of hiding because his lunch break is the only time he can be alone. And he saw this man in a golf cart going really fast down the path along the fairway. The man had a set of golf clubs on the back of his cart, but he was not hitting balls. He was in a hurry. Suddenly, he veered to his left and parked the cart near the patio of the house where the lady was murdered.
I asked you to read this passage because there's so much going on there. There's obviously the suspense and the tension. You feel that tension right along with Theo. But there's something else going on there also. You're painting a picture of a world that children might see but not really think about.
Yeah, and again, as I wrote the book and as I write the next one, I have to constantly remind myself of the world I'm portraying and who's going to be looking through it and who am I writing for? I've never had to think about that before. With 24 books now, I've never thought about who the audience is. It's always been the audience, adult fiction. This is a lot different. I think this is a tougher crowd.
Is there something in that writing about characters, a world that children know, that lives maybe just down the street, or the law is something that is real? It's not like writing about vampires or dragon slayers or something that is the stuff of fantasy.
Yeah, and one day, sometime somewhere, they're going to have an encounter with the law, and we all do. Hopefully it's pleasant, but it may not be. And look at the number of you know, foreclosures and bankruptcies that families are going through now, and the number of people who are unemployed, and, you know, maybe 13-year-old kids and 12-year-old kids are more exposed to the law than we realize.
John Grisham, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much.
A lot of fun. We'll do it again.
John Grisham's new novel, For Kids, is called Theodore Boone, Kid Lawyer.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. Something finally went as planned for the engineers at BP. Maybe. Yesterday, the company finally managed to slice off a damaged pipe that was spewing oil. Now they have lowered a containment cap over the wellhead. We do not know yet how much difference that will make with America's biggest oil spill, and President Obama is canceling a trip to Asia, heading again to the Gulf. NPR science correspondent Richard Harris is covering this story. He's in our studios live. Richard, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
So what is this cap?
Well, you can think of it as a giant funnel upside down over the well. And basically, the skinny end of this funnel is a mile-long tube that goes all the way up to a ship on the surface. And basically, the idea is to have this funnel capture the oil as it's spewing out of the well and eventually coax it up the tube. Bring it up to a ship on the surface, separate out the oil, put it in tankers, and burn off all the natural gas that's coming up with it.
So in theory, you have a problem solved, in theory.
In theory, but it's a very tricky operation. It took them, I watched them yesterday. It was a very dramatic and slow motion drama at that yesterday because it went on for hours and hours. But nothing is easy at 5,000 feet, as everyone keeps saying. But basically, they move this funnel very, very gradually over towards the top of the wellhead after they had cut off this big pipe, which they use, by the way, they use sort of hydraulic pruning shears. You can think of these enormous devices to snip this thing off. And then it took a while to clean that area up. And create a nice something that this funnel could fit on top of. But every time that funnel moved, it had, or towards the end of the evening, it had giant plumes of green stuff, which was presumably methyl alcohol that was part of the whole process. And as it moved over, basically the ship on the surface that was holding the funnel was moving too. So the ship was moving to move the funnel directly in place. And around 9:30,
move the thing at the bottom of this mile long.
Exactly, it's just amazing to watch. And about 9:30 at night, the thing went right over the well and. And you know, enormous clouds of oil resulted.
Well, let's talk about those clouds of oil because, of course, there are live feeds. I'm looking at one here at BP.com, live camera feeds of what's going on underground. And I guess as a layman, what I'd really like to see is a bunch of pipes in the water and nothing else. But what I see are huge clouds of what look like oil still spewing up into the ocean.
There still is oil spewing up, and it is really hard to tell from those feeds exactly how much. It's impossible, actually, to tell from those feeds how much oil is actually going up the pipe. It's possible that a significant amount is right now. It's also possible that they're still trying to fine-tune the system and figure out how to draw that oil up without creating methane ice crystals. That's been a problem that has dogged previous attempts to do this. If that natural gas mixed in with the oil gets in touch with ocean water, it can create these ice crystals that can plug everything up. So that's the main concern, and that was why they had that methyl alcohol, that green-tinted stuff flowing around last night.
Which reminds us how complicated the problem this is. You don't just stick a pipe there and hope that it all spews up to the surface.
That's exactly right. And they've been saying all along that they didn't expect this to capture all the oil. It's still, to your eye and mine, it still looks like an awful lot of oil down there. But it's possible. We don't know. We'll learn later today, I hope, how much they're actually able to collect some right now, and if so, how much they are collecting.
What if this doesn't work?
Well, that's a good question because BP had a number of other backup plans. Some of them they have had to discard because the well's condition is so bad that they can't do some of the backup plans they had. The other backup plans I've seen are largely fine-tuning of this. So you may recall that they have had a couple of other attempts to bring oil up from deep underwater, and those have taken a couple days to fine-tune. So maybe they can just fine-tune this and reduce the amount of oil we see spewing out, but the backup plans are tweaks that I by and large. And so if this doesn't work, They've authorized the federal government has authorized the use of a lot more dispersants down in the seafloor to at least break up some of this oil and reduce the amount of oil that makes it to the surface. They are also, of course, drilling this second well and a third well in case a second one fails.
Mm-hmm.
And
these are the relief wells.
The so-called relief wells, yeah, although they don't relieve anything. All they do is they provide a channel to put concrete down or cement down to plug up this well. So that's mid-August at the earliest, but that's basically where we're headed.
And in a couple of seconds, even if this funnel we're talking about works, it's just a temporary solution until you do that more permanently.
Until those wells are plugged, that's right.
Richard, thanks for your explanations.
My pleasure.
NPR science correspondent Richard Harris in our studios this morning. The U.S. is doing anything it can to pay its debts. We heard last week about an unusual fund at the Treasury Department inviting people to help pay down the national debt. David Kestenbaum of our Planet Money team found somebody who did.
Kay Fishburne says she can't remember exactly when she wrote her first check to the government or how much it was for, but it felt like a lot of money at the time.
Well, it is the hardest check you ever write. The first one was tough. You do get a nice thank you letter.
From the government.
Right. Yeah. The first one's tough.
Tough, but also good. Fishburne describes herself as a tightwad, and she thought our country was in more debt than it could handle. This was in the 1980s. Fishburne was working as a nurse in Wisconsin, and in her spare time, she started what, as far as I can tell, is the only organized effort ever to try to get Americans to write checks to pay off the debt. It was called Citizens for a Debt-Free America. I only realized after I found her and started talking to her that actually we'd found her before, 20 years ago. She said, "You know, I was on Morning Edition." It's true.
The group says its efforts have helped raise $10.5 million over the past 5 years. Kay Fishburne.
So today, we bring you up to date. When we talked to her 20 years ago, things were going great. Fishburne and a small group were sending out tens of thousands of letters, hand-addressing the envelopes, asking people to write checks to the government. The government? Well, it seemed very governmental about the whole thing.
There was a huge, long address for sending in the contributions. Six lines.
So she called the Treasury Department.
They changed it. It started out with Department X.
Department X?
Yeah, yeah. So just as soon as we got some printing done with Department X on it, they changed it to Department G. X sounded, I guess, a little weird. So, but G for gift I thought was very good.
And people did write in checks, a surprising number. World War II vets who wanted to help the country they'd fought for, people who had been in debt themselves. Year after year, the contributions added up.
Started out $900,000, and I think the highest was nearly $3 million.
Did you feel at some point like maybe this would work?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Americans pride themselves in getting the job done and doing things, and so I just assumed that this was going to really take off.
Fishburne did the math and figured if everyone paid 2.5% to 3% of their income every year for 10 years, we could lick this thing. Now, Fishburne says she was of two minds about the project. Her teenage kids were kind of embarrassed by it. And the whole thing did feel a little utopian, is the word she used.
I mean, it's outrageous. You've got to admit that.
Did you feel that way at the time?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, it's so off the wall that that's what appealed to people.
Just this year, we ran up $341 billion in new debt. That's our legislators and our president trying to buy our vote this year with what used to be our money. We're not that dumb.
Fishburne wasn't the only one. That was Ross Perot running for president in 1992. And about that time, people sort of stopped responding to Fishburne's letters. Maybe everyone figured the government was going to deal with it. In the 1990s, the government actually started running a surplus. Kay hasn't sent in any checks for a while, but she's paid what she had calculated was her share.
At the end of 1993, we were paid up. I don't owe anything on the debt.
Did you feel like you'd paid off your credit card or something?
Well, I thought like I'd set something right. But, of course, we know that it's still growing and in all likelihood will.
Even without Kay Fishburne's efforts, people still donate money to help pay down the debt. This fiscal year so far, $1.6 million, which, by the way, is about 0.00001% of the debt. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, the barbershop guys weigh in on the oil spill blame game, and they ask whether President Obama can show that he's angry. But first, our Faith Matters conversation, where we talk about matters of faith and spirituality. Today, we're talking about starting over. 3.5 years ago, Ted Haggard was at the top of his game. He was a senior pastor of a megachurch in Colorado Springs that he and his wife built from the ground up. He had a post of national prominence in the evangelical movement. Haggard even had the ear of President George W. Bush. But his life imploded after a male prostitute said Haggard had paid him for sex and drugs. Haggard denied the specific allegations, but he agreed that some of his behavior had been inappropriate. It sparked a national scandal. He was driven out of his church, out of his home, even out of Colorado. Now, Ted Haggard and his wife are back in Colorado Springs. They're remaking their lives. This week, Ted Haggard announced that he and his wife are starting a new church, and he's with us now from his home in Colorado Springs to tell us more about it. Reverend Haggard, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you. It's a joy to be with you this morning.
Now, you said that on the day that you announced this news on Wednesday, that this was your resurrection day. What do you mean by that?
Oh, it's true. I feel so alive. Forgiveness is a wonderful thing. Redemption is a wonderful thing. The opportunity to have a second chance is a wonderful thing. And that's how I feel, as we're starting our church and people are responding and people are so kind and wonderful. And I just appreciate the fact that they're willing to take the risk to trust me again.
And when you say forgiveness and redemption, of whom are you speaking? Are you speaking in the theological sense that you feel that you have been redeemed and reconciled with God? Or are you talking about your community? Of whom are you speaking?
Well, both. The being redeemed and forgiven by God is easy because Jesus provided for that, and God anticipated the fact that all of us would be sinners and fail and need forgiveness from Him. So that's taken care of. The difficult part is difficult from people, from society, because, of course, there's a lot of hurt and betrayal and broken hearts, and what I did disappointed people 3.5 years ago, but I've just been amazed at the kindness and gentleness in people, because God knows that people are failures, and people know that people are failures. And so after appropriate time has passed now, people are being very kind to us, and we appreciate it very much.
Well, you know, I spoke with your wife, Gail Haggard, about her book, Why I Stayed, a couple of months ago. It was in February, and she talked about people and how they can be. And she talked about what it was like to have the leadership of the church you founded demand that you leave not just the church and your home, but the whole state. I just want to play a short clip from our conversation. Here it is.
I understand that they felt it was best for everyone. I found it to be a very corporate approach and disrespectful of the relationships that were involved. I felt we would have all healed better if we had pulled together and faced each other and got the problem out in the open and talked about it together.
Now, it's been almost 4 years since then. What is your understanding now of why your former church, which you built, those leaders wanted you so far gone, felt to the point of really wanting you to leave the area? And how will that experience, do you think, inform the way you lead this new church?
Yeah, I still do not know why they did what they did. But as you say, that was 4 years ago. And in the same way I am asking people to forgive me and be kind to me, I have certainly forgiven those folks for making their decisions the way they did, and I forgive them. But now we're 4 years down the road, and so things are very, very different now. And those people that did those things have released all the contracts that were imposed upon us, and they have been quiet. And sometimes people can endorse you, other times people can just be quiet, and they've chosen to be quiet, which I appreciate, and that gives us the freedom to do what our current leadership team thinks is best to do.
And what is the mission of your new church? Can you describe it? What do you feel specifically called to do in this new church?
The formal slogan is doing our faith. The folksy slogan is give someone a break. And what we want to do, when I went through that process, of course, what was so heartbreaking, I wanted people to respond to my failure in a helpful way, instead of a punitive, hateful, cruel way. So now I want to spend the rest of my life being kind and compassionate and helpful and constructive in my response to people that are going through their darkest area. And it could be sexual immorality, it could be drugs, it could be a financial collapse, it could be a marriage breakup. But when they're in their darkest hour, I want to make sure I'm constructive, helpful, redemptive, practical. And so I call my current position a love reformation. I want to launch a love reformation because I think there's too much cruelty on the internet and on television and radio. And I think we need to start practicing more kindness and more love because life is tough for people enough already. And we need to help one another more. That's what I want to do.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're having our weekly Faith Matters conversation with the Reverend Ted Haggard. You may remember him. He was a former nationally prominent evangelical leader 3.5 years ago. He left the church he founded after accusations of sexual impropriety with a male prostitute. Reverend Haggard denied the specific allegations against him, but there was an impropriety. And now he's starting a new church, and we're talking about that. Can I ask you what your message will be about and your teachings will be about sexuality? Because you, at the time, after the scandal broke, you entered a therapy program. Your wife was very candid about some of the process that you went through in the course of that. The clear message I got from her book and from your public speaking in the wake of that was that you felt that your behavior was kind of a part of your brokenness. So what I'm curious about is, what is your teaching about sexual orientation going to be henceforward? Do you believe that same-sex attraction is inherently a sign of brokenness, or is there some other message?
Oh, no, I don't think my story necessarily applies to anybody else. I think the therapists and the psychologists and psychiatrists and those who are doing brain science research, they're going to inform all of us a lot about what develops an attraction in us. I mean, even an attraction between Cheerios and Chex and Fruit Loops. And much less the complexity of sexual attraction and sexual behaviors. The research on that is going to be wonderful over the next 30 or 40 years, and we're going to learn so much. So my teaching is going to be I have two areas. Number one is inside the church. Inside the church, our responsibility is to study the scriptures, access the ministry of the Holy Spirit in our personal lives, and encourage one another. And outside the church, though, we have responsibilities as citizens. And I think there are lots of things that we discuss inside the church that are ideals that the Lord gives us that we struggle toward here on the earth. Love your brother, forgive one another, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then outside the church, we don't have laws that require that people love one another. And so some things we believe that we don't want in law, and the same is true with sexuality. I believe that sexuality should be in a committed relationship. I believe the Bible teaches we should have heterosexual monogamous relationships, and that can be inculcated into law and form families, etc. Now, that's inside the church. How that applies outside the church in civil law is a totally different discussion. I believe in civil law there should be total equality under the law. So if heterosexuals get certain benefits for heterosexual relationships, then homosexuals should get those same benefits in their homosexual committed relationships. And that's what I'm going to teach our people. And I think the biggest step for our people is going to be what we believe inside the church may or may not apply to what we believe outside the church. For example, inside the church we believe do not murder. Outside the church we believe do not murder. But that's not necessarily the case with high school sexual behavior. High school kids, we would say, abstain until you get married. Inside the church, we'd say that. Outside the church, we would not, though, want a law where high school kids would be arrested if they became sexually active after a football game.
I understand what you're saying. I think I understand what you're saying. You're saying that inside the church, you maintain the religious deeply convicted position that marriage should be between a man and a woman, but you're saying that outside the church, you believe in marriage equality, that you would not be advocating that as an extension and as a fulfillment of in civil law. That's interesting. How is that message being received in your community?
Actually, I taught that before the scandal and believed it before the scandal. I remember back in 1992 when Amendment 2 was going on here in Colorado Springs, I explained that on a Bill Moyer show, and they edited it so that I was portrayed as a right-wing guy that was not a defender of civil liberties, and I was disappointed in that. Mm-hmm. But I think just like people want stereotypes, they want people to be in nice boxes, gay, straight, bi, whatever. Republican, Democrat, for the political view. They also want people to be in boxes regarding if you're a Christian, then you're like this. If you're a secularist, you're like that. I think there are more dotted lines than there are heavy black lines. And that's why I think people need to be kind to one another and listen to one another and really communicate and know that people believe what they believe for reasons, by and large, and that we need to listen. And if we'll keep listening and keep talking, then we'll all create a better society, I think.
Do you have a name for the new church?
St. James Church, and that's named after the author of the book of James, where he wrote, "Faith without works is dead. In other words, do your faith.
Do your faith. I see. And finally, do you have a sense of what it is that you hope for? You started preaching to, as you are starting now, small groups, 50, 100, 200, and then grew to a church of
14,000.
Thousands. Is that what you hope for again?
No, I don't have numerical hopes or goals with St. James. I'm too old for that. I'm a little tired, and I've been beaten up. I've had adequate rejection for a lifetime. And so I want to meet with those who want to meet, and I'm going to be contented and satisfied with that. And if that means 80 people, that's fine. If it means 8,000, that's fine too. I'll do the same things regardless of the number of people that decide to come and participate. But certainly, I would rather have more participate than less.
Ted Haggard is the former senior pastor at New Life Church in Colorado Springs. He and his wife, Gail Haggard, are building a new place of worship. They're calling it St. James Church. It will be located in Colorado Springs. Reverend Haggard, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Well, thank you so much. It was good to hear from you.